welcome to the show. I'm Peter Whittle. Now, before I introduce my guest this week, just a couple of dates for your diary. You know, our local events are really going great guns across the country. We've got two coming up. Well, we've got more than two, but two, the ones I'm going to highlight today. One is on Tuesday, 12th of March, which is this coming Tuesday, and that is in Nottingham. And then the following one is on March the 19th, which is a Tuesday, and that's in Southampton. So if you're in either of those places and you'd like to come along, please do. It's completely free. They're in the evening, these events. And the best thing to do is write to locals at newcultureforum.org.uk. And I hope to see you there. That's great. Now, over the past month, we've been highlighting an awful lot the fact that extremism, and particularly so-called Islamophobia, is very, very much in the news at the moment. New definitions being promised, and the Prime Minister referring to it in his recent speech on Downing Street. So it's very, very timely that my guest today has written a report about it. Tim Dieppe is head of public policy for Christian Concern. His report, which you can download at the site for the Free Speech Union, FSU, is called Banning Islamophobia, Blasphemy Law by the Back Door. Here it is. There's also an introduction to it by Richard Dawkins. As I said, Tim, thanks. You were on with us last year. Events have moved on somewhat, but indeed, then at the same time, yes, intensified, I think you'd say. You are concerned mostly, because we'll talk about the extremist thing generally, but you're concerned mostly here with this definition that's been adopted by almost every political party in many, many local councils of what Islamophobia is.
Yes.
Could you just explain, first of all, that actual definition? What is it?
Yeah. Yes. So there's an all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims, and they put out a report defining Islamophobia in 2018, actually, and they define Islamophobia as follows. Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets Muslimness or perceived Muslimness.
Right.
That's the definition there. So, and immediately, I can see, and you can see, lots of problems with that. First of all, racism, really? Islam is not a race. Yeah, Muslims themselves don't think Islam is a race. Yeah. You know, it's not a race. There's no racial aspect to Islam. There are plenty of Muslims from all different ethnicities around the place. And so why are you defining it as a type of racism here? Because it's not a race, it's not racism. So first, the definition is wrong-footed from the very start. Islamophobia is a type of racism. Well, it's not, you know. And then even the word itself, Islamophobia, says, you know, Islam is your problem, not Muslims. Mm. So, you know, have you got a problem with Islam? Then you are Islamophobic. I don't like that, because I do have a problem with Islam. I don't agree with it. I'm not a Muslim myself. Therefore, I'm going to disagree with certain aspects of what Islam teaches, because otherwise I'd be a Muslim. Mm. But I'm not. So I'm surely, you know, if just for disagreeing with Islamic teaching, does that make me Islamophobic? Well, according to this definition, it could be.
Actually, isn't it right as well that because you go into great detail in this, but also actually for that matter, so does the definition, doesn't it? Mm. There are certain particular things relating to Islam historically, which would now be considered Islamophobic. If you could give us a few examples.
Yes, well, they provide some examples of what would constitute Islamophobia in the report. Interestingly, they provide no examples of what would not constitute Islamophobia, but there are lots of examples of what would constitute Islamophobia. Yeah. One of them, for example, is saying that Islam spread by the sword. Mm. Well, that's a matter of historical facts, really. Yeah. I mean, many Muslims throughout history would say we spread by the sword. You know, Muhammad was a warrior, and Islam spread through large parts of the world through battles and conquest. You know, so what are you going to say? Historians are Islamophobic for relating actual history.
Yeah.
Another example that's suddenly popped up into relevance recently, of course, is to say, you know, alleging that claims of his genocide are exaggerated is Islamophobia. So therefore, you know, any claim made by Hamas or any Muslim group, this is genocide by Israel. Well, if I say, well, I'm not sure it really qualifies as genocide, I'm Islamophobic.
Yes.
For even questioning it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's crazy, you know, and then, you know, to say things like, it even has an example of Muhammad and says, you know, if you say Muhammad is a paedophile, you would be Islamophobic. Well, hang on, this is not about any particular person. None of the examples are about particular Muslim people. Mm. This is a question of Muhammad, and the Islamic texts themselves say that he married a girl when she was 6 years old and consummated the marriage when she was nine. One can debate whether that's paedophilia or not, but are these texts, the Islamic texts themselves, Islamophobic for stating that?
Yeah.
And why is criticism of Muhammad himself and his character something deemed Islamophobic? Because I have lots of questions about Muhammad's character and the way he treated women and the violence he had and the fact he had slaves and all of these kind of things. Is it Islamophobic to point out these things that are in Islamic texts there?
So this is something that obviously has been adopted, as I said, by, well, certainly by Labour. So basically, the real problem for this is that it will probably end up being embedded in law, won't it?
Well, the problem is that when this definition was proposed, very quickly, lots of people said, ah, we're adopting this definition. Yeah. It seemed like lots of people were waiting for some definition and they just adopted it without really questioning it, without really thinking about what it really means. And the Labour Party, as you say, has formally adopted it, as has the Green Party, the Liberal Democrat Party, the Scottish National Party, Plaid Cymru. All the Scottish parties have adopted it. In fact, all the mainstream parties have adopted it, with one exception, which is the Conservatives, who haven't adopted it. And they've adopted it in their code of conduct. So if, as a member of one of those parties, you say something that somebody says, remember, this is also in the definition, perceived Muslimness.
You're
against perceived Muslimness. So it's a perception-based definition. So if you say something somebody perceives as Islamophobic, you've broken the code. You could be expelled from the party and thrown out of the party for that. And so there basically is a silencing system or code in relation to Islam when it comes to the mainstream political parties. And we saw it most famously illustrated by Sir Trevor Phillips.
Yes, you highlight that particular case in your piece here, don't you?
So Sir Trevor Phillips is a member of the Labour Party, former head of the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, has worked with Labour on lots of policies before. And somebody came up and said, ah, but we think he's Islamophobic because he's said things like, in surveys, Muslims say this. Is that Islamophobic to say that? And various other actual facts that he cited about Muslims or Islam, they said, this is Islamophobic. And a huge dossier was produced against him. And they said, you're being investigated. And in the meantime, you're suspended from the party for Islamophobia. And, you know, a few years later, he was quietly reinstated. On what basis, who knows? It's all confidential. But the fact is that even a high-profile person like him can be picked on and suspended on allegations of Islamophobia, at risk of being losing his place in the party. Everybody else in the Labour Party knows that that's what could happen if an allegation of Islamophobia is made against you, and it's not clear how you can ever clear yourself, given it's based on perceived Muslimness, and allegations like this, there's no clarity on what doesn't count as Islamophobia. So you could be expelled from the party for it. And then if Labour wants to bring in, there is pressure. The EPPG that produced this said, we want the government to formally adopt this in law. Members of the Labour Party want it to be formally adopted in a legal thing. The influence of Islam and politics has become far more evident in the last few weeks. Labour will be under a lot of pressure to bring this into law. And as a Labour MP who knows that this is in the code of conduct of the Labour Party, are you going to vote against it?
Are you going
to say, I don't like this? Would you be accused of being Islamophobic for not adopting the Islamophobia definition? Presumably you could be.
There's actually a slightly rich irony in Sir Trevor Phillips being done. Because I think he's, by his own admission, he was one of the people, who was basically key in getting it popularised as a term in the UK, wasn't he?
Yes.
Back in the 1990s, I believe.
The Runnymede report he brought out on Islamophobia, and that did bring the term into popular use. He wasn't the first person to introduce the term, but it definitely did popularise the term, bring it into the political speak and so on, and he has subsequently said he regrets that. Yeah. And of course, then now it's been used against him. Irony of ironies, it's very ironic, yes.
Just go back to this point about Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. So, for example, if you have got a real problem with the burqa, could one say that that is therefore, could under this be Islamophobic? If you say, I think we should ban the burqa.
Well, that people have been called Islamophobic for saying exactly that. Certainly there'll be people who say wearing a burqa is Muslim and or a form of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you say, I don't agree with the burqa, you could be deemed Islamophobic. There's no mm-hmm. definition of what actually constitutes Islam that you're phobic of. Mm. You know, there are versions of Islam that don't agree with the burqa, of course, and there are versions that do agree with it. You could be Islamophobic for criticising either of them, it seems to me,
yeah.
Because there's no clarity on what actually Islam is in this context.
Yeah.
Yes, I think you could be fall foul of Islamophobia for criticising any Islamic practice, even the treatment of women or saying what it teaches about polygamy or slaves or whatever. You know, Muhammad taught about this, Muhammad taught about that. Islamic teaching says this, Islamic teaching on jihad. You could be called Islamophobic for highlighting these things. And I don't see there's any defence here. There's no defence of it being true.
I think there's in fact, as you say, it's already the case you can be criticised for it. And indeed, I think that the police maybe as well, when it comes to online stuff, they have kind of certain phrases and words they look out for. I think, if I remember from City Hall days, that ban the burqa was one of them. This was something that kind of just flagged people up, you know, not maybe in and of itself, but it flagged people up. The point really is this, people, yes, are done for this, like we've just seen with Trevor Phillips, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. The big question is, if this is embedded in legislation, mm-hmm. isn't there something called the Race Equality Act, which mm-hmm. Labour have promised. Mm. This could be their different definition of Islamophobia, could it not?
Yes.
It actually ends up going on the statute book.
Well, that's it. They define it, according to this, as a type of racism. And therefore, according to that, it would fit in their Race Equality Act. And so it could. And I think we're that close to having, effectively, yes. an Islamic blasphemy law.
Yes.
And I think I hope this is an election issue, as the whole Islam thing has stirred itself up in the last few months and things. I really hope it becomes an election issue. And I hope people realise, and I hope parliamentarian or political candidates are asked, mm. you know, would you support this definition or would you oppose it? Or would you oppose bringing this definition into law in hustings and so on? And I hope they have to pledge not to do it, because I think this is a defining moment. If we get to a point where it's illegal to criticise Islam, we've lost a fundamental freedom in our culture, a really fundamental freedom. And it's a centuries old thing that has suddenly gone overnight. And we're coming that close to it, I think.
Do you think as well that this definition, for example, has been tacitly taken on board by, for example, the likes of the BBC? You know, they don't actually have to have a definition as such.
Mm-hmm.
But would you say it's the sort of thing that probably they work by? I mean,
I don't know about that. I think that there is, you know, a self-censorship or a self-imposed thing when it comes to Islam, isn't
yeah,
there? You know,
yeah.
people don't want to speak out about Islam. This is why, for example, you know, we're thinking about extremism now. And, you know, the government's proposing to redefine extremism because they daren't name it as Islam or Islamic extremism here. They want to make it more general and they daren't really name and talk about what it's really about here. And you do see that across the media generally. I think that people are scared to talk about this or afraid to talk about it. And in politics as well, mm. Because the Islamic vote is increasing and its influence is increasing. On the one hand, that's just simple demographics. On the other hand, of course, there are threats to MPs, concerns for their safety. Journalists saying, an MP said to me, I considered my safety before deciding where to vote on Gaza, for example. That's another whole way. And obviously, we had Sir Damus Amos, who was killed, assassinated, one should say, by an Islamist. And in Parliament, in the media, the Islamic connection, that was hardly mentioned. I mean, in Parliament, I was shocked because the debate about it was all about, this is social media, we need to do
social
something
media.
About social media.
Mm.
It wasn't about Islam.
Mm.
But the chap who murdered him said, I was motivated by the Quran, I was motivated by the example of Muhammad. You know, that was why he did it. It wasn't about social media at all. You know, so, but the people are scared to say that that's what it's about here. And you've had Mike Freer saying, I'm going to step down because I have too many threats and I'm too worried about this. And, it's a real problem when it gets to MPs feeling worried about their safety because of a particular ideology which they dare not name.
But also, MPs worrying about their safety, as you say, therefore wanting to be seen to vote in a certain way, wanting to be seen. But then you have people as, you know, senior figures such as the leader, not the leader, but the Speaker of the House of Commons, effectively sort of more or less admitting this is the case. And as you mentioned there as well about the social media thing with Sir David Amos, is that here we are, Tim, talking about Islamophobia, when it's only, what is it, 2 weeks ago? Or since we had this shocking situation where Parliament was actually being, you know, thwarted, or should we say, you know...
Parliamentary procedure or protocol was breached because of safety concerns, because of Islamic protests outside Parliament. I mean, that's actually what happened. And so our democratic system was affected by security concerns from Islamic protests outside Parliament.
But when we sort of see, well, I found last week when the Prime Minister came out onto Downing Street steps, made that quite brief, I thought, pathetic speech, actually, that's my view. But there was again, there was this equivalence being drawn, wasn't there?
Yes.
It's almost like we cannot actually say the real threat and leave it at that. We've got to bring in this far right thing, right? No one will be more specific than that, and they still haven't been. No one is actually saying, well, yes, what is this? And this is now basically what you would say the narrative is that it's extremism across the board. Don't you find it utterly frustrating? Because for me, when they won't sort of say, look, the main threat is Islamism, it seems to me to be undercut people's resolve. If you also talk about the far right, it allows people to sort of equivocate and say, oh, well, you know, they're all bad as one another, etc.
And they're all equally dangerous, and they're all such a big equivalent threat to democracy, an equivalent threat to our society, which they're not. I mean, it's well known that it's like 75% plus of terrorism cases and terrorism convictions are Islamic, and investigations, ongoing investigations currently and so on, are Islamic. So they're not equivalent threats, they're not equivalent problems. I mean, I think some MPs have started to speak out more boldly. I mean, Suella Braverman, I think, is being fairly explicit. Robert Jenrick is being fairly explicit. Cammie Badnock is being fairly explicit. But you're right, in general, they dare not name it, they dare not talk about it. And I think, you know, the Labour Party in particular, I'm concerned about, because more of their seats have got high Islamic populations or portions. Obviously, they lost the Rochdale by-election recently to an extremist, George Galloway, appealing to that vote. Obviously, they feel massively under pressure about their stance on Israel and Gaza, which is a political stance about, you know, relating to Islam. And so the influence of Islam on our politics is, has massively increased in the last few years. And the evidence of it is just here to see. And the demonstrations in the streets, you know, Jews being afraid to go into central London every weekend because of the demonstrations, you know, genocidal slogans broadcast or displayed on Parliament and so on. You know, it's our society has been shaken by what we've seen.
Very much. I still think there are a lot of people who've got to wake up. Actually, but I think, yes, it certainly has concentrated the mind of many. We are promised this new definition of extremism generally. I don't know whether you've got any sort of instinct about where that might go. One thing seems to be sure, though, that it's going to become broader than it already is. This would be, therefore, again, it's to actually, if you like, take the spotlight away from Islam and Islamophobia. I actually have got here, I think, don't let me down, phone. I do. Here we go. As it stands at the moment, this is the prevent strategy definition of extremism in Britain. It's vocal or active opposition to fundamental British values, including democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty, and mutual respect and tolerance of different faiths and beliefs. So it's tolerance of different faiths and beliefs. From what I can understand, in fact, they've been quite clear about it, they want to actually broaden that. How you broaden something so vague and nebulous, I do not know. But I mean, how would that be broadened?
I don't know, Peter. I think it's very, because that is pretty broad as it stands, isn't it? You know, fundamental British values, including democracy, freedom, liberty, tolerance, respect, etc. Where do you go next? And I know that Miriam Cates, for example, in The Telegraph said she thinks a wider definition could include people who oppose same-sex marriage or people who oppose pro-life, for example, or oppose other existing laws that they don't agree with or whatever. And then, you know, that's ridiculous to call those people extremists. They're not extreme. They're not extremists in the sense that people normally mean, which is like, you know, considering changing the nation by, you know, violent means possibly and overthrowing democracy or whatever. You know, nothing like that. You know, they're arguing for, by through democratic means for changes in society and so on. So I think it's very concerning that they're doing it. And I think they're avoiding the issue, the real issue, which is Islam and Islamic extremism in particular.
Yes.
By, you know, and it's another symptom of the problem. We dare not name the real problem. Let's call it extremism in general.
Yes.
Rather than actually tackling what we know is the real problem here and where the threats are coming from and where the intimidation is coming from, which is Islamic extremism.
And of course, it seems to me logical that with the demographic growth of Islam or Muslims in Britain, that the if you like, even if you accept that there is a percentage of people amongst the Muslim population who are extreme, and it might be quite small, whatever, but it's going to therefore grow in numbers, isn't it? As in fact, the population grows, simple as that.
Yes.
The more Islam you have, the more likely.
You know, if you do surveys, like the kind of surveys that Trevor Phillips was accused of being Islamophobic for citing, you know, the portions of Muslims who would say, broadly speaking, they like Sharia law, is quite high. You know, I mean, it's, I don't know, 30-40%, something like that.
Yes, it is.
You know, it's not a tiny proportion. And the portion of Muslims who would, you know, support some kind of blasphemy code in relation to Islam would be very, very high indeed. Really, really high. Or the portion of Muslims who would want to send their kids to Islamic schools or, you know, promote Islamic values in society or whatever. You know, so yes, the portion that would actually advocate or carry out violence would be quite small. But then these other broader areas that influence politics as well and so on would be a lot higher.
Oh, yes. I mean, exactly. And it sort of allows, it gives a much wider water for people to swim in, doesn't it? One thing that's interesting that you brought along with you, actually, as well, I'd love for you to explain it if you could. But this is actually, this is entitled Fatwa on the Necessity of Opposing Islamophobia. Can you explain this to us exactly? What is this actually?
Well, a fatwa, as we all learnt 30 years ago when Salman Rushdie bought his book, that was the first time I think I learnt the word and many other people in this country learnt the word. There was a fatwa, a legal ruling. Islamic is legal. Islamic legal opinion or Islamic legal ruling is what it is. And many Muslims consider these kind of things binding, depending who bought the fatwa out. This one was published on the website, defineislamophobia.com. It's no longer public on the website, though the link still works to actually get it. And it's in the link is in the report there. And it's very interesting because, yeah, it's a bit of a, you know, 5 pages or so, but it says here, according to the principles of the higher objectives of the Sharia, the crux of the matter is the signifier, not the signifier. That's a quote from an Islamic source. In other words, we should not be arguing over technical details relating to the definition, but rather concern ourselves with the essence, i.e. what service the definition might do for the Ummah. Now, the Ummah is the global Islamic community.
Yep.
And later on it says, to sign up to something that is beneficial for the Ummah is from the Sunnah, as the Prophet said, and it quotes another Islamic source. Sunnah is Islamic traditions. So this is basically saying, let's not argue about this. Here's a definition. It's going to help the Ummah. Yeah. It's going to help the Islamic community. So we all have an Islamic duty then, under Islamic law, to support this definition and get on board behind it. And that's just very interesting because one of the examples cited in the original APP definition report of what would be Islamophobic is accusing Muslims of being more loyal to the Ummah than to, say, Britain or somewhere else. And this is exactly what this says. You know, you need to do things beneficial for the Ummah. So that would this fatwa itself would be Islamophobic, according to their own definition. But there we are. It's just very interesting to see an Islamic legal ruling that says we should support this because it's going to benefit Muslims. Not because it'll benefit wider society, of course. Not because it'll benefit free speech, of course, or any other reason than that.
So it's a piece of practical advice, isn't it, really, basically? You know, I mean, this is, as you say, this is good for us, so let's just go along with it. But that is actually there in black and white, isn't it? But you can actually see that if you search on this Define Islam.
Yes.
Define Islamophobia.
If you, it's referenced in my report for the Free Speech Union.
Okay.
And there's a link in there, and you can download it.
All right.
And it's available on some other websites as well. But if you search for the quote that I replied, you get it as well.
Thank you very much for that, Tim. It just is occurring to me, I'm not being flippant here, if this definition actually became embedded in law, we'd be done for our discussion today, wouldn't we?
Yes.
This whole discussion, virtually, we've covered the waterfront.
Yes. Yes. So they'll bring it up as an example, like they brought up all the examples of Trevor Phillips, which went back years.
Yeah.
Right? Things he'd said before, I'm sure, before they actually adopted the definition, and said, there we go, he's Islamophobic, so you should suspend him. So yes, you and I, Peter, will be in court. Yeah, we'll get there together. Maybe you'll see you in prison. Yeah.
Thank you very, very much for explaining all of that. The report you should really get a hold of and read. Totally free. You can just download it. It's on the FSU website, Free Speech Union website. Banning Islamophobia, blasphemy law by the back door. Thank you once again, Tim.
Thank you.
And I think that should give you an idea of quite how serious this is. Okay, we shall see you next week. Thanks. Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.